Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to be talking about the history of the Olympic Games for the next hour. We're going to start off with Donald Kyle, who is a professor and former chair in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Arlington. He is the author of Sport and Spectacle in the Ancient World. And Professor Kyle, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you. Always glad to be involved with NPR.
All right. I was reading from the People's Almanac in the first edition about the very ancient Greek games, and it says that the origin of the Greek games held at Olympia is steeped in myth, but it seems certain that some form of athletic contest took place for centuries before their recorded beginning date of 776 BC. Is that something you agree with?
That's under revision now, Jim. There's been a lot of recent archaeology on the early centuries of the site of Olympia. And a new book on what are called the Olympic victor lists challenges the date of 776 as accurate. What archaeology seems to suggest is that there was an early cult to the god Zeus, the head male god of the Greek pantheon, from probably the 10th century B.C. on. And that games emerged probably after 776, more like 720, 700, thereabouts, in terms of any kind of significant gathering of Greeks to compete.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been rituals and very informal local participation previous to that, but if we're talking about what most people imagine the ancient Olympics to be, I think you want to move that date down.
And so now the first modern Olympic Games... Athens, Greece?
Athens, Greece, 1896, according to most people anyway, although the Greeks will point out, and modern scholarship has pointed out, that there were, in fact, Olympic Games held in Athens previous to that by the Greeks themselves, Decalus and others, from the 1850s on, in fact. But they were basically Greeks within a Greek competition, and they didn't have the international exposure that the 1896 games had.
What I know that there probably were attempts to revive the Olympics through those centuries prior to 1896,
right.
But what happened to really get the games back on track at that point?
Well, the primary figure here is Pierre de Coubertin, a French nobleman who came up with the idea of very expanded international games, but there were precursors. He kind of borrowed that idea from a British gentleman, and there were organizations and so forth previously. In fact, a Greek poet as early as 1830s, Soutsos, was writing poetry that called for the revival of the games. What Coubertin did was create international enthusiasm for this. He gathered people in Paris earlier, and he kind of manipulated this. I'm not trying to badmouth it because he got the job done. But he kind of manipulated this by aligning the modern Olympics with the cause of amateur sport, which really was not the case in the ancient world at all.
There you had people whose sole purpose was to be an Olympiad?
To win victory, yes. If you're talking about the ancient games?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Basically, the qualifications for entering the ancient Olympics in Greece, what I call the oily trinity, free male Greeks. Probably from fairly comfortable circumstances because they needed time and money to train and go to the site of the Olympics, which always at this sanctuary of Olympia. And really it was part of their ideology of victory, competitiveness. To win at the ancient Olympics implied that you had the favor of the gods, that you were the best of the best. So it really was quite a phenomenon for them.
Was it at the first modern Olympics in Athens, Greece, in 1896 that the marathon was instituted?
Yes, it was what we call an indented tradition. Basically, since it was held in Greece and we wanted to incorporate the Greeks as much as possible, it was invented at that time. The actual historical precedent for this was not an actual race. It was back at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC when the Persians attacked in northern Athens. The Athenians sent a runner, a guy by the name of Philippides, off to Sparta, another state, since Sparta was a major military power at that time, to request aid. And so this poor guy, always amuses me, ran something like 130 miles, from Athens to Sparta and requested aid. Unfortunately, the Spartans were having one of their major festivals at the time called the Carnia. And so they said they couldn't come right away, that they would come later. So this poor guy had to run the same distance back to Athens with bad news. But the actual notion of a marathon run, this guy running to the battle and then running back to Athens with the good news and dropping dead and so forth, that doesn't come from that particular time, from the 5th century. It really, it's an idea that evolved over time. And the actual inspiration for the 1896 is a poem by Robert Browning.
Oh.
So we have been pretty flexible in borrowing things from the ancient world to buttress the prestige of the modern Olympics.
We're talking about the history of the Olympic Games with Donald Kyle, who is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Arlington. He's the author of Sport and Spectacle in the Ancient World. It was published by Blackwell last year. Tell us about the book.
Oh, well, it's what we do as professors. We're under a certain amount of pressure, and it's a proof of our scholarship. This came about when Blackwell invited me to do this as a kind of a general book for the 04 Olympics. And I have been researching and studying this stuff for decades, and I actually teach a course here on ancient sport. And I wanted, forgive me, Jim, I wanted to get past the Olympics. I wanted to show that there were physical contests long before that, that there were games in each of the Greek city-states, and there were hundreds and hundreds of these, and also to go even further to talk about Roman performances, spectacles, and so forth, and to sort of demythologize not just the ancient Olympics, but the whole notion of ancient sport and athletics and Roman spectacles.
The 2008 Games in Beijing have been marked so far by anti-government protests by Tibetans, drawing attention to China's human rights record. As much as we have seen of the attempts to put out the flame and to take the flame away from the runners, how does this compare with the previous protests of past Olympic Games?
Well, there were occasional boycotts and problems with the ancient Olympics, but generally what we have here is a phenomenon, if we use 776, a phenomenon that went on continuously for over 1,000 years. What's going on in the modern times is really a modern reaction to this. Now, that doesn't mean that the ancient Olympics were without politics, because you have what is called an interstate sanctuary, a sacred area, but it is within the geographical and political realm of a state called Elis. And so Elis provides the administrators, the judges, and so forth. So it's impossible to avoid a certain political overtone to all this. And Elis got tied up in wars and other things. So what you have here is, like the modern games, a showplace, a stage for publicity. It's a way for people in ancient times to show that they're great athletes, but there were political agendas there. People would put up monuments and push the agendas of their individual state. But what we have in the modern world, of course, is really a massive global phenomena with all this extra technology. So I think it's going to be quite fascinating to see how this unfolds in Beijing. It's a turning point in many ways to have the games in China. Unfortunately, I think there will be more protests. It's just too big a stage to give up for people that want to get the word out.
Mm-hmm. The 1916 Berlin Games were canceled because of World War I. Have there been other games that have been canceled?
Well, in ancient times, the games weren't canceled. There was one incident in AD BC when a Roman general by the name of Sulla transferred the games, all we think but the one short sprint race, to the city of Rome. But that was kind of an aberration. Generally, they were almost always continuous.
When were the first games held in the United States?
You got me there. It would be St. Louis.
That's right, 1904.
1904.
That would be the third Olympics staged with a World's Fair, the St. Louis Exposition, at that same time.
Right. Many of the early ones were coordinated with other events to try to get the thing going. 1896 was a good start. But the earliest several games really weren't that major, and it really wasn't until after World War I that things really took off. Interestingly, I kind of see this in many ways as an Atlantic phenomenon because of the involvement of the Americans and Canadians really assisting what it was largely a European phenomenon to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Another irony is, of course, the 1936 Games, the Games in Berlin, which some people call the Nazi Olympics. The Germans actually brought to the 1936 Games a real sense of grandeur, spectacle, all the rest of it. The actual torch race, or I should say the torch relay, was created by the Germans in 36 with the intention of sort of hallowing the games and drawing threads back to the ancient past. And there's a certain nostalgia that's still involved in this, what we do in terms of lighting the torch and the relay and the rings and all the rest. But many of these things are not very accurate as far as ancient roots. But in a modern mass, sort of depersonalized society, we really have a sense of nostalgia. We want to look back and believe that there was a simpler time and that in some way, you know, we're connected to those people.
If you'd like to join this conversation about the history of the Olympic Games, then all you have to do is call us in Madison at 263-1890 or call us toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. As we talk with Don Kyle, who is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Texas at Arlington, also a former chair of the department up until 2006, and has been studying the Olympic Games for many, many years, and has written a book which came out last year called Sport and Spectacle in the Ancient World. It's published by Blackwell. I was reading the account of the marathon that was held in connection with the Olympic Games in St. Louis, and there was a Cuban postman who raised money for passage by running around Havana's public square, but in New Orleans, the story goes, he lost his money in a dice game. Not unusual. He hitchhiked his way to St. Louis, where a group of U.S. weightlifters who were kind of amused and touched by the plight shared their food and lodging. And he went to the mats in marathon starting line in trousers, long sleeve shirt, and street shoes. But an American clipped off his sleeves and pant legs. So it was an unusual marathon at that time.
Well, there are many wonderful stories about the modern Olympics. It's really not my expertise, but I always think of the Jamaican bobsled team and all the rest of it. But in ancient times, that wouldn't have been a problem because that particular athlete wouldn't have any clothes on at all.
Oh, they would have ran that naked?
Completely naked, yeah, as of about, not from the very beginning. It, by tradition, was introduced around 720. We want to probably bring that down a few years, but we really still debate why they competed in the nude. But unless you were in one of the equestrian events, chariot racing or riding horses, you had to be completely nude. You would have warmed up and put olive oil on yourself. And so it would be a very different phenomenon. You would have no numbers, no endorsements, no identification. It probably has roots either in the cultic tradition where nudity is a pure form. You're going through some kind of rite of initiation. It may have to do with nude reviews and inspection of the youth. Many people trace it back to ancient Sparta. But it became universal in Greek athletics. Once it's on at the Olympics, it filters out from the Olympics to other games throughout the mainland and even in the extended Greek world in South Italy and elsewhere.
Talking about the history of the Olympic Games with Don Kyle, who is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Arlington. And we'll take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us this morning as we talk about the history of the Olympic Games. Our guest, Don Kyle, professor of history at the University of Texas at Arlington and the author of Sport and Spectacle in the Ancient World. And we'll start with a phone call from Randy in Reedsburg. Go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Say, thank you for this conversation. I wonder, you know, I was fortunate to do a fair amount of traveling in that area, and I've got a question for you. Came out of some of my observations with in traveling there, those populations, having observed and dealt with those events for centuries, now come away with modern events, looking at them somewhat symbolically, and are able to think past. The American population sometimes is more prey to the urgent, and I wonder if you could comment, is it my observation, or yours as well, that maybe We are a little more now for a while going to be have to learn, like the world already has maybe, to think beyond sometimes the urgent, and we are a little more gullible to what we're presented sometimes, where they, because they've had this long history, world populations sometimes think past us with what they're presented because they've had these long histories.
And I think that's a very good observation, Randy. There is a different sense of time, a different sense of urgency when you get to the continent. I mean, America, I'm a Canadian, and Canada even more so, we're fairly young nations. You know, our history is still fairly short. If you look at something like the Parthenon or Notre Dame in Paris, you have kind of a sense of awe, and you really get a perspective on this. But it also ties into a notion of modern sport. Ancient sport was very closely tied to religion. So at ancient Olympian stuff, you kind of had the notion that the gods were watching. There were a lot of rituals, there was a sacred oath, a sacred truce, and so forth. In the modern Olympics, it really has become very modern and global. It's tied into secularism, and it's really tied into what one scholar, Alan Gutman, calls quantification and rationalization. We measure everything. In the ancient Olympics and the early games, they were not standardized. The racetracks in different Greek cities had different lengths. And so there was no stopwatch, there was no exact measurement of throws and this sort of thing. So there was more of an involvement in what the French call the longue durée, that you're part of a tradition. Whereas in modern times, we really are very immediate and urgent. We want to win. We want to win in many ways at all costs. The Greeks certainly understood this. But we are now engaged in things like doping and so forth that are a little depressing. The Greeks did not have doping. What they had, basically, were more psychological assistance, you know, prayers to the gods, the notion that you had trained. You actually had to train for 10 months before you could enter the ancient Olympics. You had to actually be in the nearby city of Elis under supervision for a month before the games. They probably made sure that you were worthy of competition, both physically and morally. And so there was much more of the ritual. We've tried to capture that. Unfortunately, some of the rituals that people associate most frequently with the Olympics, like the torch relay and so forth, or the marathon run, this sort of stuff, they're just not ancient. They're sort of inspired by ancient, but they're really modern phenomena.
Was the original inspiration behind the games religious, or, as some other people have thought, a way of keeping soldiers in practice for war, or, as some others think, largely secular?
I don't think it was largely secular, although the context there can be mixed. What we have is a pre-existent religious festival. So your people are coming together on a regular cycle anyway, and that's tied into the stars and the planets, so that everybody, they don't have stopwatches or regular calendars, so they know when they're meeting. There are religious calendars. So you know you're going to have a crowd there. When these crowds get together, they have traditions going back to the past in their epic poetry. The great poet Homer, in the 23rd book of the Iliad, has funeral games involved with Achilles holds for his dead friend. And so they had these mythical and legendary traditions of games, and so they had an ideology of competition amongst themselves. So if they're hanging around at the religious festival, they're going to spontaneously compete against each other, and that becomes part of the religious festival. The actual games, the program of contests, becomes embedded within the religious festival at Olympia, and this does kind of hallow it. I don't see this as surrogate warfare. I don't see this as preparation for warfare. Many of the ancients themselves pointed out that you're not going to have much opportunity to win in a war if you're throwing discuses and this sort of stuff, and you're not going to do it completely in the nude.
Mm-hmm.
At best, it's what we call an indirect preparation for warfare. You certainly would make you fit, and there's the psychology of competition. And some of these events were really pretty brutal, even by modern standards. There's what would they call the combat event, wrestling and so forth, but we have a pancration. It's an all-in form of fighting, which is very much like extreme fighting nowadays, and you could do everything except bite and gouge. You really could disable your opponent. The only way the guy could get out was either to be injured or to submit. And they were so intense in their competition, so trained and so ferocious, really, about this, that they wouldn't want to give up. They'd rather be injured than give up. This is, you know, kind of wired into intense athletics. And the poet Pindar says that if you lost, basically, you kind of slunk back home by back streets. You were embarrassed. Not just participating. You really had to win. It was very much about being the best.
When were women allowed to compete in the Olympic Games?
Never. Short answer. I'm sorry. Women were banned from the site. Okay, the only way women could compete would be indirectly by, if you were a wealthy woman like Kaniska of Sparta, you could enter a chariot team because you didn't actually have to be there. You didn't have to drive your own chariot. You didn't have to physically be present. But there was a ban, probably steeped in religion, that any mature woman was not allowed at the site of Olympia or nearby on pain of death. They were supposed to throw you off a cliff. Now, there was one woman, according to legend, who snuck in, a woman called Kalapatera from the island of Rhodes, from a very notorious, very famous family of athletic victors, three generations of Olympic victors. Some of my research, shows that she may not even have been there, that this was a confusion of some of the sources over time. So basically, it's all male, two categories, boys from 12 to 17, less than 18. The rest of them are males. We're talking a stadium that held 40,000, perhaps, and a sanctuary at which the crowds could have swelled to twice that. But the only female allowed to be present was a priestess of the cult of Demeter, Demeter of the Earth, Demeter Kermune. And the reason she was allowed in was simply that the stadium, previous to the development of the games, was probably used for agriculture. She's a fertility goddess of the earth. And so when they established a stadium, it's really, really very modest. They displaced the goddess to some degree, and so they had an altar, a kind of a seating area, just one seat, really. And so every 4 years when the games are on, there would be an honorary priestess of Demeter there. But otherwise, women were not allowed. There's some problems in the sources. People believe maybe that young virgin girls were allowed. I reject that. Virgin girls could come to Olympia elsewhere in time, basically, for the games of two Hera, Zeus's wife. They were held at a different time, but on the same track, just shortened by 1/6. And what they did, these young girls, was race in a distinctive costume, and what they're doing is sort of a coming-of-age ritual.
We thank you for spending time with us this morning, and know you've got work to do, so appreciate your participation.
Thanks for your interest.
Don Kyle is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Arlington. He is the author of the book, which was published last year by Blackwell, called Sport and Spectacle in the Ancient World. And in just a minute or so, we'll be talking with Hugh Lee, who is chair and professor in the Classics Department at the University of Maryland, also an author about the ancient Olympic Games called Stadia and the Starting Gates. It's published by Blackwell. That'll be coming up in just a minute or so. There have been several games that have been canceled in the modern times, in 1916, 1940, and 1944. And, of course, we've got a rocky start to the Beijing Olympic Games coming up later this year with the protests that have been going on about anti-government protests by Tibetans, drawing attention to China's human rights record, press freedom, and continued repression of the Falun Gong religious movement. U.S. filmmaker Steven Spielberg protested China's Sudan policies by withdrawing from production duties for the opening ceremonies, and seven Cuban soccer players defected during an Olympic qualifier in Florida. That's what's been going on. But in ancient times, for instance, back at the 1908 London Games, Russia objected to separate medal totals and flag flying for athletes from Finland, which Russia controlled at the time. The Finns marched with no flag at all. And then 8 years later, the Berlin Games were canceled because of World War I. the games in 1920 at Antwerp, the Olympic oath and flag showing five interlocking rings as a symbol of five continents coming together made their first appearance. The Olympic ideals state that all countries should be allowed into the games, but Germany, Austria, Bulgaria, Turkey, and Hungary were not invited, and the newly formed Soviet Union decided not to attend. So that was what was going on back in 1920 at the Antwerp Games. We're joined by Hugh Lee, who is a chair and a professor in the Classics Department at the University of Maryland. And Professor Lee, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Well, nice to be there with you.
Thank you so much. We heard from Don Kyle, who is a historian and a colleague of yours who studies the Olympics histories. And we talked a bit about the ancient games, even prior to 1908. How far back do you consider that the Olympics have been held?
Well, they go back traditionally to the year 776 BC. That's what a lot of Greeks thought when they thought about the origin of the games. But the actual origins are a little bit mysterious. We know they went back into the 8th century BC, but what exactly these first games consisted of is not clear. The point, though, is that they're very, very old. And then they lasted until about 393 AD, so more than 1,100 years.
I have it from a reference that the first recorded game took place in 776, as you mentioned, and there was just one event. What was that event?
We're told by a much later Greek writer that the event was a running event of 200 meters, and that this was the only event for about 50 years. So it's kind of interesting for us to think of the very first Olympic Games consisting of a 200-meter sprint, which lasts about 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm. And so we've got the javelin, the discus, boxing, wrestling, all of the other events being added later.
Yes. We know the Greeks practiced these events, but, of course, your question is whether or not they were part of the Olympic Games, and apparently they were not. And when you mentioned the javelin and the discus and also the long jump, which we associate, of course, with the field events of track and field, one important difference between the ancient and modern games is that there was actually no separate contest for jumping. This is the long jump, the discus, and the javelin. Rather, they were part of an all-around event called the pentathlon, and this consisted of five contests: jumping, javelin, and discus. And if there was no winner after the first three events, the athletes then ran, and if there was still no winner, then they wrestled, and by some kind of a scoring system, they managed to come up with a winner. So you had to be, in other words, if you were a discus thrower, you probably had to be a good jumper and a javelin thrower as well, and also be versatile enough to be a good wrestler and a good runner if the contest came to those events.
Professor Lee mentioned the pancratium, or pancratium.
Yes.
A quite different contest. This is fight to the finish?
Right. Yeah, the Greeks had boxing, which started out as bare knuckles and then went on to various kinds of gloves. They had wrestling, which meant you had to throw your opponent to the ground in three out of five falls. And then they combined boxing and wrestling, in which you could punch. You could wrestle with your opponent on the ground so that there were no falls. And the winner, as in boxing actually, was declared when either somebody got knocked out or gave up. And when you gave up, what you did was you raised your index finger, which didn't mean I'm number one. What it meant was I give up.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the history of the Olympic Games with Hugh Lee, who is chair and professor in the Classics Department at the University of Maryland and the author of Stadia. Is it Stadia? Is that how it's pronounced?
That's the name of... You're talking about the Stadion event?
The title of your book.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, the title of my book is actually the schedule and program of the ancient Olympic Games. I published in a journal called Stadion, which might, that's also in my bibliography. I've actually published a couple of articles in this journal, and it's named actually for that original Greek running event, that 200-meter event that was the only Olympic event, was actually a unit of measure, about 200 meters, called a stadion.
Mm-hmm.
And this gives us the word stadium.
Yes.
It's kind of an interesting etymology that the word stadium comes, it was later associated with the place where the stadion was run.
I understand that the Olympic contests were required to train very diligently. They ate very little in the morning, but then their evening meal would be quite substantial by any measure.
Well, there were stories about that, about some of the athletes being, you know, being heavy meat eaters or being very gluttonous. Some of the stories are just kind of maybe kind of like folklore or mythology. We do know that the athletes, after, you know, we don't know exactly when this started, but at one point they were actually supposed to show up for the games about 1 month in advance of the actual competitions, and they would go to a place called Elis, spelled E-L-I-S, which is about 35 miles from Olympia. And this city, for most of Olympic history, actually supervised and administered the games. And so for 30 days before the start of the contest, the athletes would arrive, and they would train under the supervision of the judges. And in this way, what would happen is the judges would then eliminate those who were maybe less worthy. We have to remember that there were no stopwatches in the ancient world, and no common measures. The stadion distance, for example, would vary from one region to another, and so there was no way to compare distances, nowhere to compare, you know, times in foot races. And so, you know, a guy who was a great athlete from, say, Sicily, you couldn't tell if he was better or worse than a guy from Athens. And so you had to bring these guys together, eliminate those who were not as good. And so when the athletes, 2 days before the games, walked to Olympia with the judges and trainers, you had then the cream of the crop, and this would give you the best competition.
And I also understand that they all had to be nationalized on the spot, if necessary.
Well, the idea of nationalism is interesting. You know, the Greek world is not the country of Greece that today belongs to the UN with definite borders. The Greek world actually was actually much, much larger. It included the whole Mediterranean and the coast of the Black Sea and the coast of the northern coast of Africa. And what happened was there were Greek cities in all these places, hundreds of Greek cities, all of them, many of them, some of them colonies from the original Greek mainland, but many of them, or most of them, actually independent. So you had hundreds of independent city-states. And these, because they were Greek, were all eligible to compete in the Olympic Games. The Greeks were actually kind of, you know, even with this this very diffuse political setup, they nonetheless had a common sense of identity. They realized they all spoke Greek, they worshipped the same gods at places like Olympia, and they all shared certain cultural institutions like the Olympic Games. And so from one viewpoint, looking at it from say, you know, pre-Olympic Games, this was a great, you know, progressive thing that Greeks from all over the world could come together and compete in a peaceful competition where normally they were often fighting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
From our viewpoint, it looks a little bit regressive because the modern Olympics has moved to true international competition where the ancient Greeks would exclude non-Greeks.
We're talking with Hugh Lee, who is the chair and professor in the Classics Department at the University of Maryland, and we will take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and glad to have you along with us today as we talk with Hugh Lee, chair and professor in the Classics Department at the University of Maryland, about the history of the Olympic Games. And if you'd like to join us, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. You mentioned that that only the Greeks were taking part in the early Olympic Games. But I understand that there was quite an event that took place when Roman Emperor Nero arrived in 66 A.D.
Yes, and as the games got passed, for, you know, further and farther into the Roman period, well, the Romans actually had conquered what we think of as the Greek world in 146 B.C. And I guess because of political pressure, among other things, eventually members of the imperial family wanted to compete, and so they were allowed in the Olympic Games. And above all, of course, was the Emperor Nero, who actually, using his political clout, had the games delayed so he could, you know, get his entourage and all of his chariots over to Olympia to compete. And there was a kind of a scandal because he actually fell out of his chariot, but was nonetheless declared the winner because it was assumed that he would have won had he stayed in the chariot. So this is clearly, you know, political pressure being felt by the judges at Olympia. And there's a further a kind of a coda to this story, because when the emperor was deposed in 69 A.D., the Olympic officials then went and they removed his name from the list of Olympic victors, so they were pretty much embarrassed by the whole situation.
If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open for you in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. We talked earlier about the first modern Olympic Games, Athens, Greece, 1896. Were the lineup of the events pretty much the same as they are today?
The 1896 Games actually had a much more limited program. They tried to include events which, at that time, you know, the state of our knowledge by people who worked in classics, thought belonged in the program of the games, and so they included the running events and track and field and boxing and wrestling. But then the program over the decades has expanded enormously. Until now, we all know, we have actually Winter and Summer Olympics, there's so many events we actually have to split the program in half like this. So the games now are much, much bigger than they were in 1896. And even the 1896 games, I believe, had events that actually were not part of the ancient Greek Olympics.
I was reading an account of the marathon race where a water carrier and devoutly religious man by the name of Spyridon Loas.
Yes, he's a Greek, actually.
Yes,
yes.
Prepared for the race by praying for two nights and fasting the day before. So tell us what happened during that race.
I don't remember the exact details, but this was an event of enormous pride to the Greeks, that a Greek runner actually won this event. And but I think, as you kind of hinted, this event was actually not part of the ancient Olympics. The ancient Olympics actually didn't have a race longer than 5,000 meters, or roughly about 3.5 miles. There's a lot of confusion. It's become a part of modern Olympic lore, modern sports mythology, that the ancient Greeks, ran a marathon as part of the games. But actually, when you look at the records and the literature and the surviving lists of victors, there was clearly no marathon in the ancient games. So this was clearly a modern invention, and then it's part of course, the marathon. The Battle of Marathon was obviously a point of great pride on the part of the ancient and modern Greeks when the Greeks defeated the Persians back in 490 and 480 BC. And so you can understand that still young Greek nation in 1896 wanting to somehow commemorate this great event from their history.
4 years later, the Olympics were held as a sidelight to the French International Exposition in Paris, and it says that French politicians got control and almost ruined the games. How did they do that?
Well, you have to remember that the 1896 games were the brainchild, or the founded by a Frenchman named Pierre de Coubertin. And what's really interesting here is what's been learned in the last 20 years. We tend to think of the first modern Olympics as taking place in 1896, the so-called Coubertin Olympics. And Coubertin does deserve credit for making the modern Olympic Games truly international. And so it's kind of logical that the French would therefore have a crack at the second Olympic Games. I mean, there was really a question, should the first so-called modern Olympics be held in Greece or Paris? And then, of course, if you have Greece first and then Paris next, you kind of solve the problem. But what's been learned recently is that there actually were Olympic movements throughout Europe in the 19th century. Places like Sweden and Hungary and England all had various movements, local movements, to try and recreate the Olympic Games. Greece, which, of course, freed itself from the Ottoman Turks in the early 19th century, was, of course, the one that maybe had the greatest claim to reviving the Olympics. But this was part of a kind of a European movement. And what had been lost until about the last 20 years, until the research of Professor David Young, a classics professor at Florida, was that the Greeks themselves in 1859, in 1870, and in 1875 held Olympic Games in Athens. And Coubertin actually borrowed from this idea, but it seems that he wanted to get the full credit for reviving the Games, and so he tended to downplay these earlier Olympic Games held in the city of Athens, and apparently they were quite successful. They were not truly international like Coubertin's games, but one set of games did invite Greeks from the Greek world, but also people from across the Aegean, from the remnants of the Ottoman Empire. So the idea that the Olympic Games suddenly arose in 1896 is something of a fiction.
All right, we're talking with Hugh Lee, chair and professor of the Classics Department at the University of Maryland. I read of the games in 1904 in St. Louis, the third Olympics staged with the World's Fair, the St. Louis Exposition, and that there was quite a bit of controversy regarding the marathon in which Fred Lors, an American, was quite involved.
You're going to have to remind me about that.
He was the early marathon leader. He was an American, and his pace forced him to the sidelines by the halfway mark. He accepted a lift in a truck, which soon overtook the competition, and about 5 miles from the finish, the truck broke down, and he got out, and he's now going to jog to keep his muscles loose. When he arrived at the stadium, the crowd thought he was the winner. He decided to play along, but ended that just before presentation of the cup, he confessed that he'd ridden part of the way.
I see. That's quite a story. I wasn't familiar with that story. It's good that he confessed. It reminds us of the incident in the New York Marathon a few years ago, I guess it was, where some woman took the subway and actually claimed the medal and actually had to be forced to confess that she was a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, the de Coubertin, who was involved in setting up the first of the modern games, he was apparently dismayed at the poor attendance of the French games and the American-dominated St. Louis games, and he suggested separate events at Athens, and the Greeks welcomed that idea, but apparently that just sort of petered out.
Well, yeah, if you look in the Olympic records, the list of the games and the victors, there's a curious anomaly. We all know, of course, that the games are supposed to be held every 4 years, and this is, of course, following the ancient example. But if you look in the record books, there's actually a 1906 Olympics, and this was held at Athens, and it was due to this actual controversy. So you can see that the birth of the modern Olympics actually involved a lot of nationalistic and political feelings involved. And so when we look today at the modern political controversies, you can see that even from the very beginning, the modern Olympics have been embroiled in politics of various kinds.
One of the things that has always been of some controversy is whether or not the athletes themselves are amateurs or professionals, and that's plagued Olympic committees since ancient times. Avery Brundage, the longtime U.S. Olympic official, espoused strict amateurism. What is it like today?
Well, actually, again, because of the efforts of people like Professor David Young from Florida, in the last 20 years, we've finally gotten to something resembling the ancient Olympics. This division between amateurs and professional didn't exist in the whole history of the ancient Olympic Games. Again, it's a modern mythology or misunderstanding of what happened in antiquity. In the ancient Olympic Games, the winners only received an olive crown, an olive wreath at Olympia. And so this is obviously symbolic. It's just a bunch of twigs and leaves and of no financial value. But the prestige of an Olympic victory was enormous. I mean, you won in the greatest games in honor of Zeus. Now, these winners, although they got nothing financially rewarding from Olympia itself, when they went home, they could receive cash handouts from their cities, pensions for life, free meals in City Hall, so things of financial value. Just as today, in fact, if you watch when the Olympics occur, you will see countries offering prizes to victors from their own nationality for first, second, or third prize. Gold medals, of course, bringing you more money. Now, in the ancient Greek world, athletes then, as I said, received all kinds of remuneration from their home cities, but also these athletes, being great athletes, could then tour the Greek world, and the ancient tour of the Greek world of athletic festivals was something like what you see in the modern golf or tennis tour. Every week there's a tournament in a different place, and so a Greek athlete could become very, very rich from winning these prizes. And we know from the prizes awarded that the amount of money really is comparable to the $1 million that they say the winner of the Masters can take home from just winning in an event on a weekend. And so these athletes were really near the top of the socioeconomic scale because of their athletic prowess. And so the athletes had two kinds of games they could go to: some prestigious because they were sacred games in honor of a god, others which gave a financial prize which they could take home and eventually make them very rich. The modern founders of the game sort of confused these ideas, and they were also influenced by the ideas of 19th century British aristocrats who didn't want to mingle with working class people. And so this code of amateurism arose, which excluded the very best athletes from competition. Now, this was not the spirit of the ancient games, which was to give a venue for the very best athletes to compete, and in which we could therefore see the truest excellence of the human body and spirit. And so, when we jump ahead now to 1992 and the famous American Dream Team, the basketball team with Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, this was in some ways the first time that the professional athletes could now truly enter the Olympics. And so we have then finally reached the same situation of the ancient games, where the Olympics are supposed to be a place where the very best athletes can show their skills and prove that they're the best.
When did we finally see an electric timing device used for these races?
I can't tell you the exact date. I remember, of course, myself, back in the 60s and maybe even in the 70s, stopwatches and judges eyeballing the finish. But I would say maybe the 70s or 80s. I'm not exactly sure about the introduction of the electronic mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. In 1912 in Stockholm, Sweden, was the debut of Jim Thorpe as an Olympic hero.
Yeah, that's a very inspiring but also a tragic event. And of course, Thorpe was caught in this Avery Brundage's definition of amateurism, and the fact that he played minor league baseball and for not a whole lot of money automatically excluded him in the eyes of Brundage from being a pure amateur and therefore being able to keep his Olympic prize. But as part of this correction of erroneous history, along with the permission to allow professional athletes to compete in the Olympic Games, was the relatively recent restoration of Jim Thorpe's medal. So gradually, I think we're beginning to understand more completely ancient Olympic history, and not using false Olympic history to help us to create a kind of a false Olympics.
Now, we didn't have an Olympics in 1916 due to the war.
Yes.
And in 1920, the defeated nations were not invited. Russia also did not compete until 1952.
Yeah.
But it's the debut of the Flying Finn, Paavo Nurmi.
Yes.
he became a legend. And one reporter called him a mechanical Frankenstein created to annihilate time.
Mm. Wow. That's, you know, when I read, you know, about Paul Mannermy, I'm always inspired by his hard work and his training. I'm not sure I would call him a Frankenstein. I think we're kind of getting out now into the issue of either, you know, things like blood doping, and not to mention drugs, and then where the line is. And this is obviously a very delicate ground. I don't think Nerming was involved in anything that was questionable, but he certainly trained very hard. And this, again, this may be getting into something of this kind of this false idea of the amateur that was introduced into the Olympics. That again, if you work too hard at sports, you were giving it too much time and effort. And a true gentleman, you know, doesn't, of course, put that much emphasis in sport. If sports becomes work for you, then
we've
you're
got to we've got to leave it
sure.
here because we've run out of time. Thanks okay. so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Hugh Lee is a professor at the University of Maryland in the Classics Department. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.